Can you tell me about your sweatshirt, by the way?
My sweatshirt was inspired by our arch enemy.
Yes.
She indicated on one of her tweets, not even to us. She was just ranting at someone.
As she often does.
And she said, get off my tweets.
Now. It's like, that's what the block function is for.
That's right. And so so that's what my new hoodie says that. I got it from Beaver Shams, Mrs. Beaver Shams Emporium.
Maybe we'll put it on our
podcast. Yeah, we'll put it on our podcast
Twitter
notes and say that we gave her a shout out. But she's had a lot of great fun material.
Especially if you like beavers.
If you like beavers. And her little animated beaver is so cute. She's hilarious.
I believe I got you a mug.
Hi, and welcome to Gen Extemporaneous. This is a podcast where I come up with an idea, I do some research, I grab a bottle of wine, I bring everything to Mark, and he pontificates. Today, we are diving into our childhoods once again to discuss all the wild and weird and potentially dangerous fads that we followed during the 70s and 80s. Gen X had an amazing number of weird toys and foods and trends that we followed, and many of our Twitter friends were kind enough to share their favorites with us. Join us as we slip and slide down memory lane, and don't take it too personally if we make fun of your pet rock. We got our sensitivity chips late in life, and we're still learning how to use them. Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso. So one thing I have to clear up right from the beginning, that for whatever reason, because I was often the new kid because we moved a lot, or because I lived overseas for a while, or just I'm just generally nerdy, I was always like about a year or two late for fads.
Ah.
Plus, I was very suspicious of them.
Okay.
Right? Because I was feeling, you know, like everybody's getting a different haircut. I'm like, that could be gone tomorrow, and then I'm stuck with this dumbass haircut, right? That's why I didn't cut my hair, like, up over my ears, 80s fashion, right, until, like, my freshman year of college.
Wow.
But, like, remember the knit ties?
Yeah.
Right, the sock ties, I called them? Instead of adopting that as a fashion trend, I decided to go the other way and just mock them mercilessly, which got me some traction with some of my peer group.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I just missed out on probably it was a pretty preppy, cool trend. So that's me. So if I'm a little bit behind on some of these things, that's who I am.
Well, give me a hot take on fads. I have your personal hot take.
Right.
Give me a hot take on fads.
So, of course, once in each generation, a fad is born. You know, from swallowing goldfish to stuffing yourselves into phone booths, wearing beaver fur, jackets
and,
or coats,
those
whatever.
Those big coats from the 1920s,
there
the
you
fur
go.
Coats. Yeah.
So rah-rah, sis boom bah.
Yeah.
To fraternities, preppiness, punk rock, various and sundry toys and foods, etc. Every generation has their fads. And often, you know, they burn out pretty quickly, right? It was a fad, it's hot, it's Cabbage Patch, boom, it's gone. You know, sometimes it sticks around for, you know, a decade or so. So I'm excited to get into this. You know, pop culture is, you know, one of my things.
Yep.
Love it.
Well, we had a lot of great feedback from people who responded to our Twitter question about it. And we are going to get there in just a minute. But first, I thought it would be fun to talk a little bit about how fads work. How
do you even know this?
Specialists say fads work. And then also to do a little bit of a deep dive into history, because you know I love to do that. So let's start with things that are how fads happen from the top down. So sometimes fads happen where things are created for elites and then they adopt it. And then copies start to spring up because people want to mimic what elites are doing.
Do you know what that makes me think of?
The Devil Wears Prada.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
As a matter of fact, that's a scene that I wanted to talk about.
Anne Hathaway comes in wearing some TJ Maxx cable knit sweater, right? Miranda, you know, somebody pulls out some belts and she goes, you know, I just can't decide. They're so different. And honestly, to my eyes, they look like exactly the fucking same, right?
Right.
And Anne Hathaway gives a little snicker. She's like, that's hilarious. And Miranda is very serious and she goes, why are you laughing? She's like, well, because they look exactly the same. She goes, they're not. It's whatever.
Cerulean blue.
There you go.
Yep.
And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that In 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns, and then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think we need a jacket here. Mm. And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
Things she wears that she gets from TJ Maxx ultimately started in the couture houses.
Oh, no, I think that that is true. And that's exactly what they're talking about. Those fads start somewhere and then they come on down to a more affordable level and people jump onto that bandwagon. But by the time people like us are jumping onto that
bandwagon, it's a great unwashed.
The trends are already
being
made.
They've moved on.
They've moved on. All right. So the another way that fads happen are sort of symbolic. So what they say.
Give me an example of a symbolic fad.
And this would be more like social contagion, where someone develops an emotional connection with an idea or a concept or an object. And then others around them kind of catch that connection.
Right.
So people might adopt a fad because of the meanings and assumptions that they share with the other people who have adopted that fad. Streaking probably would be one of these.
Well,
or diet fads would be another one of these.
Well, when I was a streaker back in the day, I was a little bit young, actually, to try to pull that off. I would have been streaking in like the sixth grade, which is problematic on a couple of levels.
Yes.
Not in the 70s. Nobody would have given a fuck, but no. I would have. And, but yeah, that I can see how like the social contagion thing, like jamming people into phone booths. Right.
It's because
there's no damn good reason for it,
No, you're part of a group. It is like the group think it is a group doing something that they like. For those of our people that have followed our podcast for a while, say the Wilverse is that.
Oh, for sure.
I'd say that there's an object who is him that they've formed an emotional connection with that has now informed their daily lives. And they have a group of people they like to be a part of that group who is doing that. Likewise, I would say the side that dislikes him have also formed an emotional connection to him. It's not a warm emotional connection. It's it's almost like an aversion.
Well, it's a negative relationship.
Right. And in the same way, so they've made friends around the idea that they don't like him.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are just misanthropists who hate everyone and equally want to just hate the people.
They just dislike,
like you.
Just a joke.
Misanthropic son of a bitch. Okay.
I love humans.
All right, so that's symbolic. Then there's opportunistic. And that
seems cynical.
That is cynical, and it's particularly from a business perspective.
Oh,
so
sure.
It's different from the top down. It's because that is innovative, right?
Yes.
So the top down, especially like in fashion, it would be innovative. Opportunistic is you see a situation.
Yeah.
You know that this object or this thing that you create would be useful in this situation. Or popular in this situation, and you create it to fill that need. COVID.
Yeah, because they were like, that virus is very popular. Let's come up with a new one that's very similar to the bird flu.
No. It's this. They recognized that people were going to need hand sanitizer.
Right.
And so businesses that previously didn't do hand sanitizer turned their businesses into hand sanitizer.
Yeah.
I'll give you the example of in Scotland, there's a company called BrewDog, which is a Scottish brewery giant. They responded to the pandemic with the production of brew gel and hand sanitizer for distribution across Scotland to help curb COVID. How do fads end?
Well, I don't know. People get bored.
They do.
They burn out.
Essentially, it is that they get bored. The market becomes overcrowded. So like the fidget spinners thing, everything it's overcrowded. It's old. They're not fidgeting anymore. They're just like, well, whatever. We did that. That's done.
You know what I think is a good predictor of when a fad's going to end? When you see it on Facebook. You're like, oh, okay. Now my mom's into this. I'm out.
Once the faddists are no longer producing new variations of the fad, people begin to realize their neglect of other activities. And that's a jarring thing because you get very used to being in that groove and then you have to break that
habit. And another
thing
is you might just be sitting in your house. You're like, excuse me, who are you? You can't just barge into my house. And they're like, I'm your daughter.
Right, exactly.
Like, I live here.
That's exactly right.
I haven't seen you in a while, but I do live here, I swear.
Okay, so let's talk about some historical fads. I think some of these that you'll know about. I think some of them.
I'm very well versed in fads.
I for sure am going to, you're going to know this one right off the bat. So in the 16th century.
Yes, of course. Oh, they're very faddy back then.
The tulip craze.
Yes. So for whatever reason, and you'll back me up with like actual historic facts, but I like to, you know, kind of bloviate for a little while before you do that. So for whatever reason, people started valuing tulips, and there may have been some scarcity of certain
tulips,
varieties.
Yeah, tulips take 7 years to fully develop into a variety.
Which is a
You know, and they were a unique plant because of their very vivid coloring. They came to Europe from the Ottoman Empire, and so they became
an entire empire based on putting your feet up. That's amazing. That's a Jerry Seinfeld joke. I'm so sorry.
And they, but they have the they're scarce, and it takes a long time for them to cultivate. And then, of course, they're very beautiful. They're very brightly colored. And then,
well, they're from my home country.
And then some of them developed a virus.
Oh.
And this particular virus caused them to become variegated. So they had like stripes on the blooms.
Oh, like that.
And so then they were really like popular. And these things became,
well, because it was scarcity, right? So that
was
driving.
Well, it was scarcity. And then it just became one of those things that I think that there was a lot of conspicuous consumption, especially because there was an emergent merchant class who had a lot of money to...
Especially in the Netherlands.
Yes, absolutely. This is the golden age. And this is, you know, like the time of Vermeer and, you know, all of those Dutch masters.
Rembrandt.
And all those, by 1636, the tulip bulb was the fourth leading export product of the Netherlands after gin, herrings, and cheese.
By 1623, the price for a single Augustus Semper tulip bulb was worth 1,000 guilders. By the end of 1625, that price had risen to 3,000 guilders. To put this into perspective, a skilled artisan such as a carpenter would earn about 300 guilders per year. So that meant that by 1625, a carpenter would have to work 10 whole years, not spend any of that on food or a house or anything. And then, after 10 years, he would finally be able to take all his money to a tulip trader and buy a single bulb.
So tulip mania reached its peak during the winter of 1636 to 1637, and they were having contracts. They were essentially trading futures.
People were buying futures, on tulips, and that became a classic financial bubble.
That's exactly right. And then there was a plague that was going on, and all of the sudden, the summer came, I guess, and they wouldn't, no one showed up for the auction. And all of a sudden people are holding these, what are now, the prices are dropping. At their peak.
You know what else they're holding? Their dicks in their hands at that point, because they are in big trouble, because they paid like 80 million guilders for these tulip futures, and they're now worth like 4 guilders. You know, they're so caught up in this fever, and that's really what a lot of fads are, right? They act like an infectious disease. Yeah. And you get this fever, you're like, yes, we got to do this. And it's like the, you know, the real estate bubble in the 90s or, you know,
Bitcoin,
whatever,
recently.
Bitcoin now, where they think like, I'm not really buying tulips. I'm buying a chance to be a billionaire.
Right.
Right. And sometimes that doesn't really work out because fads end.
Right. All right. So this one struck me funny. I bet you haven't heard of this.
All right. Whoa. I'll take that bet.
Ornamental hermits.
Nope, don't know what that is. I don't even know what that, like, are you hanging homeless people from your ears?
All right, so this is primarily in England, Ireland, Scotland. It's in the 18th century. And during the 18th century, there's kind of a cult of melancholy.
The phenomenon of the ornamental hermit is a very curious one. In the 18th century, landowners constructed buildings in their gardens, things like classical temples, for example. And some landowners in some kinds of gardens constructed hermitages. And these were either places where they could go themselves to be melancholy, Or they were places where they hired an ornamental hermit to sit in the hermitage and to represent melancholy and sobriety of thinking.
Oh, they loved moping.
You know, 1700s.
It was a very mopey century.
Yeah. No kidding. And wealthy estate owners would build these little buildings, little hermitages.
Would they invite a homeless guy to live in it?
They would go into it and have a mope.
Yeah.
Or they would hire people
to mope for them.
Recruiting a hermit wasn't always easy. Sometimes they were agricultural workers, and they were dressed in a costume, often in a druid's costume. There was no agreement on how druids dressed, but in some cases, for example, they wore what we would call a dunce's cap.
So they would be told they weren't allowed to wash or cut their hair or toenails for like years.
Yeah.
Not to wear shoes and all of that. And then those, when they would have parties, the hermits would emerge and they would dazzle the party with some poetry.
Yeah. So here's what I'm thinking. What in the actual fuck is wrong with these people?
Or they'd serve wine.
Serve wine? It's yeah. Would you like a bit of wine? Yes. You with the toenails, bring us wine. I brought him in from a cottage. Yes. Oh, he's never had his own house.
Okay, so this is worth reading.
I'm sure that it is.
This, I'm quoting at length here. A 1784 guide to the Hawkstone Estate in Shropshire, belonging to Sir Richard Hill, describes its resident hermit.
Oh, I'm sure.
All right, ready? You pull a bell and gain admittance. The hermit is generally in a sitting posture with a table before him on which is a skull, the emblem of mortality, an hourglass, a book, and a pair of spectacles. The venerable...
What is that for? I'm sure you'll tell me.
The venerable barefooted father, whose name is Francis, if he's awake, always rises up at the approach of strangers. He seems about 90 years of age, yet has all his sense to admiration. He is tolerably conversant and far from being impolite.
That is a lot.
Yeah, so it's all very symbolic, right? Like you're going there and you're seeing this guy.
I have the best hermit. So you know, right? I mean, do they brag about their hermits,
well,
I guess?
Well, this would be, you know, right. So this would be, again, kind of a conspicuous consumption thing. All right, so that I thought was a weird thing, but as it did.
Oh, you think that's a weird thing?
So it does die out.
Yes.
Except it's still present.
What do you mean?
We still do it, some of us.
Not this boy.
We have garden gnomes.
Oh, yes, we do.
And those have taken the place of...
But they don't shit.
No.
Which is a very big advantage.
They don't provide you with wisdom, but anyway,
well,
I guess
it depends
on what you've been drinking.
First, I will guarantee you there are people who think that they get wisdom from plaster gnomes. I'm sure that they do.
I'm positive they do too. Now let's move on to the 1980s.
There are still some wacky fads, right?
There are some wacky fads.
Wacky?
Wacky or dangerous or fun to remember.
Or silly.
Shrinky Dinks.
Shrinky Dinks, suggested by Gen X Girls Grow Up.
All right. Gen X Girls Grow Up. Shrinky Dinks were...
Now, I never used Shrinky
Dinks.
You never
did.
Or did Shrinky Dinks. No.
These plastic
shapes. Like you baked them, right?
Yeah. And you would draw on them first. You would do the drawing.
And then it would get
them,
smaller?
Color them. And then you put them in the oven.
Yeah.
And you had to have a parent who was helping you.
Well, allegedly. This is the 80s. Yeah, come on.
And then they
would... I'm going to use the oven unsupervised. Is that okay? Yeah, whatever. Quit interrupting me. I'm smoking.
Yeah. That's actually so true.
I 100% guarantee you it's true. And my parents were wonderful parents, but I guarantee you they would say something like that. So,
mom's having a cigarette. Please.
Yeah, please leave mom alone. Oh, by the way, I'm doing it in the house with no windows open. Enjoy your cancer.
Will be fine.
Yes. Hi, did you have emphysema? No, then shut up.
So they were created by Betty Morris of Brookfield, Wisconsin.
Ooh, Wisconsin.
I know, right?
That's your home state.
My home state.
Ain't it there, hey?
Uh-huh. And They were so much fun. I actually liked them because you could take them out, then you would punch a hole in the top and they would become
Christmas
ornaments. Yeah.
Or, yeah, like, it's all like, look, we have the shittiest looking Christmas tree on the block because we've used Chris's shrinky dinks.
Don't always call me Chris.
At that age, you were Chris.
I know, but I'm not Chris now.
But you were when you were making shrinky dink ornaments.
Oh, my God. All right. So the thin, flexible sheets were, like I said, cut into shapes and color. And I don't know.
Did you crayon color them?
No, I think it was markers. I think you have markers.
Again,
that
I didn't
use.
Do shrinky dinks.
So. I don't remember painting.
Did I explain to you how I wasn't always on the cutting edge of all fads?
Yeah, of course I did. And
well,
I loved it.
Please, I guarantee you, Christina was on the cutting edge of every fad in the 80s.
She was
a fad chaser.
Yeah, exactly. The process was so much fun. And the best part of it, though, was standing and watching the window.
And the things are just shrinking.
Yeah.
It's like, look, I made this craft. Now I'm going to heat it up and make it smaller. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. I definitely want to be a part of this process. Like, my sister may have done shrinky dinks. I don't remember.
It. All right. So, okay, the next one, I'm sure you don't know about these, but I love them, and it was my submission.
I thought that was the name of it. I'm like, were you some kind of weird BDSM person?
No.
What are you doing? You were like 7 years old. No. What is wrong with you?
It's my submission, and it was called Fashion Plate.
Oh, no. I remember the commercial for that because it had a song.
Fashion Plate.
Fashionable young ladies can now create fashions with Fashion Plates. You can change tops, bottoms, and hairstyles.
Fashion Plates.
You can give them any color you want and even choose different textures. You can make hundreds of fashionable combinations.
It's got all those fashionable traits, and they call it Fashion Plates.
Fashion Plates comes with 15 different plates and 8 coloring pencils, paper not included, by Tomy.
So I feel like you kind of constructed an outfit out of like little platelets or whatever.
Yes.
And then you slam over the holder or whatever and you create this outfit. Is that how it worked?
Right. So what you did is you closed it into a frame and you would have like the shoes and then a skirt and a top.
Right. Do you understand now why I wouldn't have done this?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And then you would close it in and then you would color over it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like
it was like a bas relief almost.
Yeah, and then you would take it off and then you would color in.
Yeah. Whatever your fashion choices were.
Right. And you would have your colored pencils or your crayons or whatever. And you
now,
would
did you have
in.
The big 64?
I had 128? Whatever.
It's 128.
So I had those.
So you had 128.
I had the
did
128
you have,
pack.
Built-in sharpener?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
Which never really worked all that well.
No rose art crayons for you.
No, it didn't.
You're
really,
full Crayola.
No, I was full Crayola. What was your favorite color? Mine was burnt sienna or periwinkle blue.
Raw umber.
Ooh.
Was a nice one.
So this was by Tomy Toys. I really enjoyed that toy.
I bet you did.
Oh, I loved it. I love those creative toys. I really did like the creative toys. Okay. This one was submitted by @MarkEatsPeach.
Oh, I know that guy.
The Spirograph.
I love, first of all, the Spirograph is awesome. So it's a little plastic wheel with teeth inside another wheel, and you stick a pen in one of the holes, and it's really an exercise in mathematics, right? So they do geometric shapes. So you just spin the pen around and it'll do this cool pattern depending on which hole you put your pen in. And it was everything.
I loved those. And they had different colored pens.
Now, there was a Spiro Tot, which was for little kids. It was really simple. It's like, oh, look, I made a star. Now you're a loser because I have Spirograph. And that's going to give me like, you know, some kind of fractal geometry design. And you suck, Spiro Tot.
Yeah. But and then some of them had like bigger teeth.
Oh, yeah.
So then you would.
Yeah, because any time you move the pen into a different hole in the thing,
it
would just make a different pattern.
Yeah, make the pattern different.
Loved Spirograph.
This was a well-known toy.
Hasbro?
By Hasbro. Was developed by British engineer Dennis Fisher.
See? Mathematic, that's what I'm telling you.
And was first sold in 1965. It was distributed by Hasbro.
See? Why don't even know why I even do any research ever.
Here's another one.
And then you would do it. And then you have this piece of paper with a design on it, and then you throw it away, like, or you left it on the table and your mom threw it away.
Right, right, right.
Never used it for anything.
Okay, so another one was slime.
Oh, Now, slime was a little later, I feel like.
That was the 80s. Slime was a toy product manufactured by Mattel, sold in a plastic trash can, and introduced in February of 1976.
Wow. I don't remember that because I didn't see it until the 80s.
I had to have been in the late 70s because why would I?
You
I
were
wouldn't have been
2 years old.
No, I was 8, 9.
Whatever.
You know, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
You know, early, like 1980 and before.
One thing I can tell you about slime, when it's in the garbage can, right, the little can that comes in, and you stick your hand in, it makes fart noises.
Yes. Everybody knows that about slime.
It's like, pfft.
Yeah, that was part of the funny part.
That was great. And then, of course, you know, you throw it on your sister, or the classic is. You get a handful of the slime, you fake sneeze, and then you have it dripping off your hand, and your sister's like, that's so gross. You're like, yeah, that's what's up. I just snotted in my hand.
Gross.
It was gross.
They would then do things like include worms or eyes into the slime.
Totally remember. I had purple slime with worms. That was my crowning achievement.
Yeah, I think I had my purple slime. Didn't it have sparkles in it? I think my purple slime had
Sounds
slime
like something has, they would do.
Yeah. And then they would also offer Masters of the Universe slime. This was in the 80s. And then you would get a kit, a Masters of the Universe set. And then they would
offer. Why was there slime in that?
And they would offer slime because
I don't understand the connection.
No, well, because it was for Hordak's slime pit.
Attention. The slime pits are overflowing and slime is erupting all over the universe.
I love slime.
It's faceless, mindless, spineless, and now it's free.
It's free.
Free when you buy any two Masters of the Universe figures. Get a free can of slime at participating stores until May 31st.
Or until slime supplies run out.
Slime, a free gift from Hordak. Will you get it before it gets you?
Very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you ever use Silly Putty?
Of course.
Oh, I loved it. To do the funnies on
Silly
Sunday.
Putty is the original Control-C, Control-V, okay?
Yeah.
In one step.
That's right.
You're like, you know what? I really like this Pogo comic. I'm going to memorialize it for 30 seconds. And you would do the putty, and you would peel it up. You're like, yes, Pogo. You go, girl,
and then,
boy. And then, whatever, I'm doing something new now. Oh, Charlie Brown now, whatever.
But it came in an egg, remember?
It did come in an egg.
I used to get that every Easter. All right, so another 80s fad. This was a biggie. Was created by Hungarian businessman Tibor Lassi.
Oh, Tibor, yeah.
And that
was it paprika?
No, Rubik's Cube.
Oh, yes. See, I thought he was Russian.
Mm-mm.
Was he? All right, so hold on. Rubik's Cube was suggested by Heather Honey 18.
All right.
And she said, I was obsessed.
Oh, were
with
you?
Rubik's Cube.
I wish we could ask her. I wish we could interview her and say, were you able to solve it? I was never able to easily solve it.
Yeah, never solved it, played around with it. I'm like, I got to the point where I could make one side the right color.
As big of a genius as you are.
Yeah, you would think, right? And what I like watching now is kids who are like, you know, they're speed solving.
Yeah.
So they like look at it for like 3 seconds. They're like, okay, start the clock. And they're like, whap, whap, whap. 6 seconds, they have a fucking solved
cube. It's a
formula.
Cube. Yeah. All right. So the final toy that we added in was Simon. All right.
I loved Simon.
It's an electronic game of short-term memory skill, and it was invented by Ralph Baer and Howard Morrison, working for a toy design firm, Marvin Glass and Associates.
Simon.
Nobody beats Simon.
I want you, Simon.
Simon is the challenge you've been waiting for because it takes coordination of hand and mind just to play the game. And if you get very good at Simon, great rewards await you.
Thank you, Simon.
Simon is waiting for you from Milton Bradley.
So I used to do it. I was pretty good at it. Like I could crush my siblings, which is the most important thing to me.
Yeah, I was pretty good at Simon too. I had good memory. I don't know how I do now.
But. Oh no, I'd be like, did it start with green? I don't even remember. Like I'd get it wrong on the first click.
I know. Yeah. For those who don't remember, it's tones and lights.
It was
machine,
a circle machine
with red,
four buttons,
blue, yellow, and green.
So it would give you a pattern, then you had to recreate it. with almost, it was very unforgiving. Like if you waited a little bit too long.
Oh yeah. Because it would speed up.
Yeah.
As the longer you would go, the faster it would.
And it's like, it's like, fuck you, Simon.
So frustrating.
Beat your ass after school.
So then the original version was manufactured and distributed by Milton Bradley and later by Hasbro after it took over Milton Bradley. Guess where Simon had its launch party?
It had the World's Fair?
No.
In St. Louis?
No.
Well, that's 1898.
Well, it went there. It had its debut and then it danced the night away.
Oh, Studio 54.
It's studio, yep.
Did the Ghostbusters play it? They played Simon until 2 a.m.
I know, yeah. So
that's hilarious.
1978, it had its debut there and then it became a pop culture symbol of the 1970s and 80s. I got it in the 70s. I can remember laying on my couch on Christmas. Yeah, I think I had it like 79. It was Christmas or my birthday maybe that I got it.
Yeah.
It had been my birthday and I was laying on the couch playing with it. I can still picture it. It's a very strong memory for me. I must have been really excited about it. So, okay, let's now talk fashion. Who suggests friendship pins?
Charmaine. You actually met her in
Canada.
Canada, eh? Mm-hmm. So she said making friendship pins and, shockingly, wearing them.
Yes. All right. So friendship pins were a huge thing.
I don't even know what that is. So tell me what it is.
All right. So you would take safety pins and you would take little beads and you would put the beads over.
Oh,
the,
okay. Yeah. I saw those.
Okay. And then if you were really
multicolored, like different color beads, like it's some kind of military insignia.
Then you would have one big one and you would hang all of those.
Big one what?
One big safety pin.
Oh, okay.
And you would hang all of the, you could hang all of those safety pins and they would be in patterns and the colors all had meaning.
I'm sure they did.
All right, so I didn't remember all of these, but just so you
lay
know,
on me.
White was for gentle or pussycat. Red was for strong.
Whoa, whoa. Did you get a lot of pussycat?
Strong, vigorous, a sweetheart. Orange was calm or a buddy. Yellow was intelligent, a good friend. Green was envious or an enemy. I don't know, you're making a friendship pin for them. It's all green. You're like, take it.
Yeah, take this, you bitch. Put it on your jean jacket. I sat up
all last night making it. Take
right.
it. I hate you.
Yeah. I would just ask for straight yellow. Just give me straight yellow.
Turquoise is sensitive. Blue is happy. Hugs and kisses. And black would be sad. Were you all black all the time? No. I mean, this was middle school. You would take it and you would put it on your jacket or you would put it on your shoes. You would take on the very front lace of your shoes. I definitely missed this trend. You would have the pins on, like, hanging on the front
of your
shoe.
Was this in, like, the late 80s or something? Mid-80s?
Yeah, it would have been the early 80s. Right. This would have been late 70s, early 80s.
I super never saw this.
In middle school. You were graduating from high school. High school students wouldn't have probably done friendship pins. This would have been the purview of middle school age kids, right. I would imagine.
That's fair. I never saw this, I don't think, ever.
Yeah, and that was a huge, huge trend. We did
really?
That. Oh, my God. I spent hours crafting those things. That's all what right. you did. What, you know, like, what else did you do?
Oh, you made those little things. Paper pyramid things where you go,
you would answer
one,
questions.
Two, three, four. Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah. You're going to marry that guy over there who's picking his nose. Just so you know. And you have no choice because destiny, you know, is spoken.
That's right. So the other fashion trend, and I can't remember if someone suggested this or I just remembered it.
Probably both.
Ribbon barrettes. You would do this for your friends.
Oh, yeah.
Too.
And it's like, and like they like hung down like a ribbon with a little bead on it.
Ribbons with beads on it.
I definitely saw that.
And you would get those, you would get the double bar barrettes. And then you
I mean, what other kind would you get?
And you would then braid in these various color ribbons. And you would have matching ones. You'd wear them on either side of your head. And they were, I loved those. Yeah. I remember a pair.
Now, I did not wear those.
No, but I remember a pair that I really loved. And they were like this lilac and white.
Mm.
Oh, and I really loved them.
Yeah, that's very fashionable. Yeah.
You would theme them to your outfit.
So of
you would
course
have,
you would.
You know, matching barrettes for every outfit. And you could do that for your friends. Okay. Here's another one. I think someone mentioned these. Jellies shoes.
Now, I do remember those. Mm-hmm. I never owned a pair because, you know. Dude, probably wore Nikes at the time, but tell us about jelly shoes.
Well, they are made of a PVC jelly. I didn't realize this.
I'm sure
they're
it's a
research.
Cancer-causing agent.
Yeah.
I guarantee you.
They were invented like in the 1950s or 60s,
yeah.
And it was probably they used PVC jelly because there wasn't leather. They theorize on that. The single event that popularized the jelly shoe, however, came, and I'm quoting at length here, from a man visiting South Africa to find products unknown in the United States. He found the jelly shoe and fell in love with the idea, especially since he'd never really seen them in the States before. He found the manufacturer and set up a few deals for large orders of the shoes. The jellies debuted at the World's Fair in 1982 and hit shelves in Bloomingdale's in 1983 in 9 different styles.
So I'm surprised by a couple of things here.
Okay.
First of all, I had no idea that there were any World's Fairs after 1898. I assume they just kind of like, whatever, that's kind of an old thing. Yeah. Whatever. We're just moving on. We've already introduced the large wheeled bicycle and the balloon, so we're fine at this point.
The penny farthing is...
Yeah, exactly. We're done.
The men have shaved off their handlebar mustaches. Yeah, exactly.
So no more. Now, apparently there's a World's Fair. You know what? We found a new thing, jelly shoes. Okay, let's activate the World's Fair.
Yeah. And then
in St. Louis, I assume.
I don't know.
That's where they all are,
1982. Like I said, debuted in Bloomingdale's.
What? Those were like $10 shoes.
Yeah, they're very inexpensive. And that was one of the selling...
It was a petroleum jelly shoe.
That was one of the selling points, is that you could have multiple pairs of those shoes. Now, I will tell you, they are uncomfortable. They are sweaty.
Yes.
And
you love them.
I had several pair of them.
Of course.
Yeah, but, you know.
You didn't worry about comfort. You were worrying about fashion.
Yeah. You know, now I think about it, and how uncomfortable.
Nobody's wearing that shit today.
Okay, so here's another one, mood rings.
Oh, I definitely remember those. Mm. And so you put on this ring, and I'm sure that stone just changed color based on like ambient temperature or something stupid like that. But it was supposed to reveal your mood, if it's green or blue or whatever. I'm sure it was completely random and definitely completely disconnected from your actual psychological state. Like, I feel murderous. What color am I? Right? No, you're green. You're placid and you're fine. Right?
So
I didn't wear a mood ring.
So social historians think that part of the reason why these became so popular in the 70s is this is one of the biggest sort of early to mid 70s trends, is that this is like the me decade where people were beginning to explore like their inner selves and really talk
and they
about
wanted
their
to
feelings.
Express it in a cheap stone.
And the color changing jewelry started, that became popular in New York City, but then obviously spread around. And it contained a temperature sensitive liquid crystal encased in quartz. And so as your body temperature rises or cools, the crystals change color. These only did this for like 2 years, and then it wouldn't do it anymore.
I suspect most of them didn't even last that long.
Right. They just kind of changed color to like a black or dark blue is what it ended up being. But
that is my mood.
There were
black.
7 colors in all, and they all had different meaning. Blue meant happy. Reddish brown meant insecure. Black meant the wearer was upset. Golden yellow was a sign of tension, and so on.
I didn't have
Something
one.
Something was going on. Now, whether it really meant that you were agitated, because scientists said it is an indicator that something was going on with you.
If you're like, you have an elevated temperature, you probably have malaria. Would be my guess. I mean, I might be a good malaria indicator. Now, you know what ring I am more familiar with?
No.
The puzzle ring.
Okay, tell me about that, because somebody suggested it.
Yeah.
I don't even know what
that is. So here's what the puzzle ring was. It was a series of interlocking metal rings that if you put together in the right way, would be like a coherent ring and you could put it on your finger. But it was a puzzle, right? It was like, you know, whatever. You had to like fit it together in the right way. And then you put it on your... I had one. Took it apart once. Huge mistake.
Couldn't get it back?
Couldn't get it back. Couldn't solve it. I'm sure I spent all of 30 seconds trying and just threw it away.
No, this is so funny because as smart as you are, your spatial...
First of all, I do... Spatial relations, let's just say, was not my highest. And that's like, you know, pilots and, you know, whatever. Uh-huh. And being able to, you know, they would show you those like a shape and say, if you folded this up, what shape would it be? I'm like, how the fuck would I know?
I'm very good at that.
Yeah. See, I'm not. Another thing that's not my thing, patience. No. Like, I like to be good at stuff immediately.
Yeah, I have patience. Here's the last fashion item.
Yeah.
I had, I think, four or five of them. I'm going to see if you can guess what it could be. And I wore them all at the same time.
Buttons.
And I had special accessories to go over them. And I had, yes, yes. You, right, you're not wrong. On. What you were, your gesture.
Buttons, right?
No, what you were doing.
Oh, like bracelets. Not charm bracelets? Charm bracelets?
Swatches.
Swatches with the different bands.
With the different bands.
Or
and
whatever.
And then you could get like the face protectors and you put that. Yeah, that was all rubber.
It was just a rubber, like, circle, straight line circle, and it would protect you from bullets, I think.
And then I did a duffel bag that was had the swatch face on it. Yeah, I was into swatches.
What are you doing with your life?
I had like four or five of them. The first one I got was gray with a pinstriped face. It was everything. I loved it.
Yeah.
I had multiple swatches.
I never owned a swatch.
I love them, and they are selling them again.
Yeah.
And I really want...
I remember being in Miami once, and there's a swatch store there still.
Yeah.
And you can go and buy your swatches. So, you know, if you want to go.
Yeah, let's go.
Let's go check it out.
All right. So their first line of 25 models. So this is like a more affordable option.
Yeah.
Fast fashion, but still good, decent quality.
Like probably $50 or something.
And no, the first 25 models sold for $19.95 to $37.50.
Well, for me, that would have been like $100.
Yeah, I wonder what it is.
$59.49 today.
So I guess for our parents, that would have been pretty decent amount of money.
I mean, that's not cheap.
You know, it's also not $10,000.
Well, no,
know?
It's not a Rolex. Come on. It's a plastic fucking watch with a piece of rubber over the front of it.
That was awesome. And they had a great commercial. I can remember it. With the Fat Boys.
Swatch! Swatch!
Oh, Fat Boys. Where are you?
So I took my dog to the vet.
Swatch him! Ha ha ha! Swatch him! Now the hands on the swatch! Oh, persistent! And the swatch is water! And shock resistant! Swatch him! Ha ha ha! Swatch him! Swatch! The new way to Swiss watches! Swatch!
All right,
the Fat Boys are back.
Let's talk about two of the 1970s and 80s pets that were weird.
Well, we know what the first one is.
What is it?
Everybody knows Pet Rock.
Pet Rock, that's right.
which, by the way, I definitely never got because at least I knew. I was like, that is stupid.
Well, you would have been 13.
Yeah, that is stupid.
And so it would have been for like little kids, right? Or
no, adults got that shit
adults
too.
Adults who were being ironic.
Right.
Like now.
It's like, hey, I have a Pet Rock, bro.
Yeah, like that would be funny, right? And what was great is it was very inexpensive.
No, of course, because it's a fucking rock.
He became a millionaire off of his idea.
Yeah.
If you're a child of the 70s, odds are you were one of the 1.5 million kids that got a Pet Rock for Christmas. The smooth stone came packaged in a cardboard box, complete with instructions for how to properly care for your new pet.
He used smooth stones from the city of Rosarito, Baja California.
Oh, yeah, Baja, Rosarito, Baja.
He got on the 10.
So you take the 10 out of the 105, if it's not backed up, you know, with construction, and you get a Pet Rock, it's awesome.
So they were marketed like live pets, and so they came in custom pet carriers, and they were the little cardboard boxes.
It was just
boxes,
super ironic, and it was a joke. It's a bit of a joke,
it
right?
It was, because he was hearing his friends talk about their pets and how, you know, they were hard to take care of, or, you know, they were time-consuming and expensive and everything else.
Here's a rock.
Here's your pet. And they would have little googly eyes on them.
Yeah, why? Like, you can make your own Pet Rock, kids.
Do you want to hear? So this is 1975. Okay, listen to this. The marketing genius about this,
this guy was a marketer from birth.
Wasn't just the fact that, you know, it was very inexpensive and the cardboard carrier was, you know, a minor expense on top of it, packaging cost. He marketed a how to care for your Pet Rock book.
Book, yeah. He's like, you know what? I'm selling you a book too.
I think it's hilarious that he did that.
Oh, it is hilarious. I mean, it's a perfect example of marketing over substance.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. Okay, and speaking of, now this is something, and this is going to actually
turn... This Tamagotchi?
No, this is going to turn into an After Dark episode, because this is a thread that I want to pull. So I know even going into this, that this subject is going to be explored at length in our Patreon.
I'm so ready. Oh, right. Yeah.
Sea monkeys.
Oh, I ordered sea monkeys.
Did you really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
So I was in Germany when I ordered these sea monkeys. Mm-hmm. I was like, I saw it on the back. Now, here's where
in
you
the
buy
back of the comic.
Yeah, here's where you buy your sea monkeys is on the back of your Beetle Bailey comic book or your Archie comic book or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Order the sea monkeys. I was like, what's this bullshit? A packet. It comes in like, it looks like a seed packet, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's just a little envelope full of bullshit. And you're like, this doesn't look like a monkey at all. I was promised by the diagram that there would be kings and queens of monkeys
right,
under the
castle.
Water. Yeah, and they had like crowns and tridents.
And there was like...
And you know what they were? Little small shrimp.
Yeah, brine shrimp.
Yeah.
And there was a little disclaimer written on the illustration.
Which, by the way, no kid ever looked at.
No.
Apparently, the product liability laws were a lot looser back then. But I definitely ordered those. I don't even remember if I ever actually put them in water. But I guarantee you they didn't. I never enjoyed them in any way.
No, we did put them in water. Mine did not hatch.
Yeah,
but
because it was in an envelope and they probably died shipping.
No, they can live for a long time.
Yeah, but they probably died in shipping.
Many people's actually did work. You know, they were supposed to grow and make babies, and then they were billed as a bowl full of happiness, instant pets.
No. They were instant, like maybe ramen.
Gross. Oh, Mark,
well,
no.
Shrimp.
So especially because...
You just don't like them because you saw a picture of them with faces and crowns. They would be shrimp.
Let me say this. They begin their lives as cysts.
Oh, what? Oh,
yes, they can last for years on a kind of suspended animation if kept in dry conditions. The thing that I want to pull the thread on in this Patreon episode that we're going to record at some point here is this guy. He was a marketing genius. However, he's problematic.
Because what a shock.
Because he had some, I think that there's some Nazi background.
Oh, wow. So did you ever buy any other crappy products like off of the TV or anything?
No. Well, you know, there were all those Ronco.
Did you do the Columbia? Did you do Ronco?
Ronco.
Did you ever do the Columbia Record Club?
Oh, God, yes.
Of course, everybody did.
People
I know those guys are looking for you.
Now
it's like you can get 11 shitty albums for free. For one penny, right? But now you have to buy 30 other shitty albums mm-hmm. for $100 each or whatever
it was. Yeah, it was. There were a lot of things like that. And they were all on like kind of late night television.
Oh, yeah.
And the
Ron Popeil.
Yeah.
Ron Popeil was the genius behind Ronco. And he would have all these...
infomercials.
He would sell these shittiest fucking products, mm-hmm. right? These were all garbage. And he would get on these infomercials and tell you about the benefits of the egg scrambler.
And the spray hair.
Yeah, which was amazing. It looked, it worked great because he was balding, right?
Yeah.
He was spraying on his head. He's like, look, full head of hair.
Oh.
Isn't it just like some gunk you sprayed on the top of your head? But whatever. But Ronco would sell, he made hundreds of millions of dollars on these horrible, horrible products.
I mean, you have a captive audience, and what else are people doing?
I mean, we didn't have the internet.
No, that's right.
We didn't know any better.
All right, so let's talk about just a couple of last miscellaneous items. Somebody suggested wacky packs. Do you remember what those
are? So are those like cards with like...
brand placement.
For one thing...
Like I can remember there being like... ketchup or something.
Yeah. For one thing, the 70s, like that's the era of like Mad Magazine and all the toys were gross out toys.
Yeah.
Right? Slime.
A lot of them were slime and...
And whatever. And like if you looked at like cartoons, they all had like, you know, weird veiny eyeballs.
Garbage Pail Kids.
Yeah. You know, all that stuff. They were very into the gross out.
Yeah. These were more like pop art. It would be like cans of soup. But Garbage Pail Kids, same thing. You had like, you could exchange them, and then they would have like those puffy stickers of the Garbage Pail Kids. One of the things that I see people talk about a lot, or I see pictures of it online, are McDonald's collectibles. And they had
like the little plastic bullshit you would get in Happy Meals or whatever.
No, the that you could get a plate. There would be a gift that was a plate. And I remember ours
like would, a little would plastic cup.
Plastic cup or you had glasses. And I remember having the
like
Grimace.
Like a jelly glass.
A jelly glass. But it was it had Grimace on it.
Grimace.
You know, I love Grimace.
You're very invested, I think, in Grimace and his origin story.
I am. Well, he's purple. And I think someone said that they joked and said that Grimace was the ancestor of Barney.
Yeah, like he's proto Barney. Yeah. Right? He hasn't quite formed into a fully articulated dinosaur. He's just kind of a blob with arms.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a lot of that, like that whole, I don't know, collectibles and trading cards. There was a lot of that, it seems.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, it's always fun to talk about these.
We love the nostalgia.
The nostalgia stuff.
Do you think we left anything out?
Oh, I'm sure that we have. And I hope that people will weigh in on Twitter if we forgot anything. We can always do a follow-up episode on it. These are always such fun things to do because there are trends that we missed. We did do.
We didn't really talk about fashion trends at all.
Well, we talked about. We didn't talk about. We didn't. And we do have a whole episode on the fashion trends of the 80s. But
yes.
I think that's one that I'd like to review. You know what? I wanted to ask you a question.
I am an open book.
In our 100th episode. If you could have another crack at an episode, keep the episode, but have another crack at redoing it, what episode would you do?
That's an excellent question. What would I want another? I was so good in all of them.
Oh, boy.
It's so hard. I would like to take another crack at 80s music.
That's
probably.
Me too. That same one.
Because we would probably go a little bit more in depth on musical trends, right? And do a little bit more research on it. But I think 80s music, which by the way, I think people would like.
I think so too. Maybe we will do that.
Who doesn't like 80s music? Communists, that's cannibals, whatever.
Right. That's right. Yeah. So, all right. Well, that was a question I meant to ask you. It's funny that we had the same one. So, Mark, I think we'll wrap up.
Do you know who knew we were wrapping up?
Mola.
Yeah, Mozart is, he's like, I can hear you have that tone in your voice where you're wrapping up the pod. I'm just going to stand up and get ready for walkies.
Why don't we tell them about our social media? We have a Twitter. We are at extemporaneous2 on Twitter. Mark is at Mark Eats Peach, and I am at Christina Gen X.
We have a Patreon, www.patreon.com/GenExtemporaneous.
That is correct.
You can join at the level of Friend of Mozart, who's right here in my lap right now.
It's the only level, and you will get
at least three extra episodes where we'll do internet archaeology,
Video Thunderdome, and extended episodes like we are going to do.
Which I've been informed we're going to do on this one.
This gentleman who invented the sea monkeys.
Sorry.
And his name, Harold von Braun.
Oh, what a shock that he's a Nazi. Wow. Wouldn't have seen that one. I did not see that one coming.
So he is going to be the guy that we are going to pull the thread on and talk about him. Okay, so I'm going to take this opportunity to say goodbye.
Auf Wiedersehen, Cop Scouts.
Thanks for coming and listening to us each week, you guys. We really appreciate it.
Peace.